Medical Matters on Talk About. Brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital, Tralee. Celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
Now, a warm welcome to Dr. Eamon Shanahan, who joins us from Farran 4. I hope the technology is all right this week, Eamon, is it?
Well, we're doing it off the phone.
Oh, we are? Okay. Very good, very good. Well, I can hear
we're
you.
We're talking,
and I can hear you loud and clear. We had a busy week last week, of course. We were delighted to be joined by Mr. Gardisi from the Bonds.
That's right.
And we got loads and loads of questions for him, which we said we would hold over. But we'll also take general queries. So if you're good to go, Eamon, we'll start.
Absolutely.
Now, I know you often smile when we get questions about cholesterol, and I think this will be no exception. Yeah. A lady in her mid-80s says she's very concerned about her cholesterol levels, which are as follows. She says cholesterol 7.2, HDL 1.3 and LDL 4.8. What does all that mean?
Yeah, and she's in her 80s.
Mid-80s.
That's the actually vastly more significant figure than the other figures. You see, what I'm driving at is that she's managed to get into her mid-80s without having had heart disease. And yes, it is still possible that she could have heart disease, but the truth of it is that she's got to her mid-80s without actually anything happening to her. And this is one of the problems. I think what people have to realise is that there is no question but that statins are of great benefit to a number of people, but for the majority of people, they actually make no difference. The difficulty is it's very difficult to tell in advance for whom statins will be a benefit and who statins will not be a benefit. It's pretty simple in one sense. If you have had a heart attack, or if you have a high risk of a heart attack, for example, a close immediate family history, that has to be the mother, father, brothers and sisters only. Don't mind talking to me about the second cousin or the aunts or the uncles, they don't count. If you have an immediate family history of premature heart disease, that's a heart attack under the age of 60 in a family member. If you yourself either have very high risk otherwise, smokers and diabetics in particular we'd be concerned about, and especially if we've had previous history of heart disease, then there's no question but you need to take a statin. For the majority of people, the jury is still out on whether or not statins make a difference to the general population or not. And I suppose the thing is I go back to where I started from. The single figure that impresses me about what our listener said is that she's in her mid-80s. She hasn't had an event, so it's almost certainly going to be the case that irrespective of her cholesterol readings, she will, when eventually she's called to the Lord, she'll be called for reasons probably of old age rather than anything else.
Okay. I hope that that makes sense to our listener, and that she's listening this afternoon. Got in touch with us this morning. Eamon, moving on, we have a mom who's concerned about her 15-month-old son. She says the issue is he has sweet-smelling urine. She says, of course I Googled it and it told me he could have MSUD. I've never heard of this. He's a picky eater and drinks about 15 ounces of milk a day.
Okay, two things. First and foremost, what's your son's weight? Now, you don't need to know the actual figure, but what I'm driving at is your public health nurse will be able to weigh your child for you and then compare his weights with that of what it would be expected for a typical 15-month-old. The reason I'm saying that is that the thing you're talking about is a metabolic disorder and generally leads to very small malnourished children and all the rest of it. So if your child is of a normal weight, that in the first instance is an assurance. Secondly, of course, is that if you continue to be concerned, you need to talk to your own GP and they can, if necessary, organise the appropriate investigations to check this out for you.
You never heard of MSUD either, I'd say, did you?
Yes, yeah. No, there is, I'm trying to think of what the acronym stands for, but basically it's one of these inherited disorders of metabolism. Again, get the weight checked, make sure that the child is thriving. If the child is thriving, that in itself is assurance, but if you need the extra assurance, talk to your own GP and they can organise whatever investigations are necessary to check it out.
Exactly.
Don't be worrying about these things.
And stay off Google when you have a symptom, as you've often said, Eamon.
We
have a female caller in her late 60s suffering from arthritis in both shoulders and both hands. She's looking for advice on pain management, Eamon.
Probably not an awful lot that people can do in terms of lifestyle, but physiotherapy is always of benefit, and I really do think that our physio colleagues should be our first port of call for virtually every musculoskeletal problem that's there. The reason I'm saying that is that even in people with arthritis, you want to maintain muscle tone. And that'll help to minimise your pain. And again, the physios are so good at doing that. Beyond that, what it boils down to really is a variety of probably one of three different medications. Anti-inflammatories, if you can tolerate them, and I'm saying that because not everybody can tolerate an anti-inflammatory medication, would be a starting point. You could also use simple analgesics. Paracetamol, two tablets, two or three times a day, can be very effective at controlling the discomfort and soreness. For people who have ongoing and severe pain, occasionally we resort to using a third class of medication. So the generic name for them are the gabapentoids. They're a centrally acting drug. They block pain signals in the brain, but they have quite significant side effects. So they'd be very much third and last choice. Start off with the simple analgesics, go on to the anti-inflammatories, but also talk to your physio.
Texter says, I have a hard lump on the top of my head. Should I worry about it?
It depends very much on whether this is something that's been there all your life or whether it's something developed recently. The timeline of these things is very important. If you've developed a hard lump on the top of your head in the last couple of days or weeks, that's a concern. If it's been something that's been there since birth, it probably isn't. It's probably just part of your skull and it's probably the way you are. It depends very much on the timeline.
Here's an interesting one, Eamon. It's a 42-year-old female and she says she seems to have very strong body odour. It's not coming from her underarms. She feels it's coming from under her skin. She works in an office, so it's not like she's doing physical work all day. And she says she showers regularly, but is wondering where is this smell coming from?
Yeah. Some people unfortunately have a state or a condition called hyperhidrosis, where even when they're not hot, that they are producing just excessive sweat, and that in turn causes them to have just that they get a lot of body odour, so that even without working they're sweating a lot. But even in the absence of sweat, there are a number of other metabolic disorders that can cause people to have sort of a lot of body odour. Probably the best thing to do is talk to your own GP. They'll organise the appropriate investigations for you. In the event that there isn't anything there, it may very well be a question of trying to find something that'll help relieve the situation. For example, there is some very particularly powerful deodorants that are antiperspirants, I should say, that people can use that can help relieve this. There's a bit more detective work, shall we say, required to come up with the answer to that.
Now, good old COVID is back, Eamon. Did it ever go away?
Never went away. A
76-year-old woman got in touch. She's living with two family members who currently have COVID. She herself had it 5 weeks ago, and she's worried that she will get. Should she be worried that she'll get it from them again?
Yeah, the answer is probably not. I mean, the fact that you've had COVID relatively recently will mean that you will have fairly high circulating levels of the antibodies in your system, and it should protect you. I suppose the only concern and difficulty is that if they happen to have a different strain to what you have, then it's then there is unfortunately a possibility you could potentially get COVID again. That said, the fact that, you see, I think part of the thing is because so many people have had COVID at this stage, circulating levels of antibodies of COVID, be it through vaccination or just because of the illness, are pretty high. So the risk is relatively small. But there's nothing to, I think there is no harm, and I think we're going to have to forever learn to live with hand hygiene and where appropriate, using face masks. And that's probably no bad thing.
Okay, Eamon, we'll take a quick break at this point and stay with us. We've lots more questions for you. And a quick reminder, if you want to phone through your question to Brenda, 066-712-3666. It's 16 minutes past two. I can tell you the sun has come out here in Tralee. My goodness, there's a miracle for you. A minor miracle anyway. Maybe it's going to clear up after all. Back with more Medical Matters in just a moment.
Medical Matters on Talk About. Brought to you in association with the Bon Secours Hospital, Tralee. Celebrating 100 years of advanced medicine and exceptional care.
Now, Dr. Eamon Shanahan is with us for this week's Medical Matters. He's taking your general queries. Eamon, we'll move on with the lady in her 40s. She says she had a very large mouth ulcer, which thankfully has disappeared, but she had it for 8 or 9 weeks. She visited an ENT specialist who was satisfied with the outcome. But our caller would like to know, why did she get this very large mouth ulcer in the first place?
Yeah, so a couple of things there. There is a miserable dose, I think, called anastasis ulcer. Anastasis ulcers can persist for long, long periods of time. and they're not uncommon. We're not really sure why people get aphthous ulcers. The only thing we know that seems to help them is if you can apply a steroid directly to the ulcer, it seems to speed up the healing process. For somebody who has a persistent ulcer, it was right and proper that you would be seen by an ear, nose and throat specialist. And I suppose then broadly we divide people into two groups, those who smoke and those who don't. Those who smoke, the difficulty and the big concern is a persistent ulcer could very well be the first sign of a mouth cancer, and though they're rare, they're not unheard of. For people who don't smoke, it may be an indication that there's some other underlying medical condition, because there are a few medical conditions, Behçet's syndrome and so on and so forth, which may cause mouth ulcers as well. So it was right and proper, you'd be checked out. But for most people, it's this thing called an aphthous ulcer, which is just a miserable and sore to us.
A male caller, age 73, says he's riddled with arthritis. He's on Oxynorm and Fetafix, but is looking for alternatives.
There isn't really. That's the problem. The difficulty is the Oxynorm is an oxycodone medication. An oxycodone is something we try to use judiciously. If people remember, there was quite a scandal, and it was an enormous and horrendous scandal in the United States about the inappropriate prescribing of oxycodone by doctors and pharmacists, and that's been a huge problem. Oxycodone, we try to limit its use here, but there are a few people where there is really, really severe pain, and oxycodone is one of the few alternatives that's there. After that, then use anti-inflammatory medications. The difficulty is that because of the destruction of the joints, you've got dry bone, grating of dry bone, and unless you have a joint that is replaceable, and as Mr. Gardasisi said last week, you replace the joints for pain, not for stiffness. This might be one of those cases where this is where it's going to have to be done.
A listener says she's 74 years old and is wondering, is it okay to keep taking lansoprazole for gastritis?
Yes. Again, it depends on why you were started on the lansoprazole in the first instance. So lansoprazole is one of a group of drugs called the proton pump inhibitors, or PPIs for short. The PPIs and lansoprazole was one of the first one of them. I think omeprazole was the very first, and they've been around since the late 1980s or early 1990s, so we've got like 30 years experience with them. Long-term high dose use of these drugs may interfere with the absorption of vitamin B12, but generally they're very well tolerated. There is a condition called a Barrett's esophagus. It's a condition where you get inflammation of the lower end of the gullet, and there is a certain amount of evidence that using these drugs can prevent this Barrett's esophagus thing becoming an esophageal cancer. So again, it goes back to why you took the medication in the first place. Sometimes, and depending on the individual and their particular situation, it may be that lifestyle modification can help. So for example, if you're somebody who's plagued with heartburns but who's carrying a bit of weight, if they lose a bit of weight, it might well take away the heartburns, and then they wouldn't need to take this class of medications.
Okay, listener says, I'm a male in my mid-50s. I have a problem with impotence. I'm on medication for blood pressure. Had my bloods done recently and they came back really good. I'm healthy otherwise. Yeah. I've tried medication for the impotence, but it didn't help. Can Dr. Amon give me some information or advice on how best to treat the problem?
Probably best to talk in that case then to the relevant specialist, who would be a urologist. And there are a number of urologists around. There's two in County Kerry, and then they're in Cork and Limerick and so on and so forth. Your own GP can arrange an appointment for you there to be seen by one of the urologists, and they would check this thing out for you. Again, there are a variety of issues there. I could spend a whole program just talking about the subject on its own, but probably in this case there are one or two things that your GP can prescribe for you. If they're not working, then you're probably going to need to see a specialist anyway.
Texter says, Deirdre, a few weeks ago you had a liver specialist on with Dr. Amon. Could you ask Amon, is that doctor taking on new patients? Could you repeat his name, and would I need a letter from my GP to go see him?
Let me take a second. Yes, the relevant specialist is taking on new patients, and yes, you will always need a referral letter from your GP. That's the way the system is set up in Ireland. After that, mate, I'm in a brain freeze. I can't remember the man's name, but your own GP will be able to find that for you quite easily.
Yeah, we'll try and get that doctor's name for you. He was from the Bonds, wasn't he? And he spoke to
That's the two of us.
Yeah, we'll try and get that for that listener. And if we don't have it by the end of the programme, we'll phone that listener up with it. But in any case, we get asked that a lot, Eamon. You can't just phone up a specialist and say,
no,
I want to see you.
Okay, again, there's a half an hour discussion in that. Ireland, the UK, unlike many other parts of the world, the medical councils of both countries have for a long time had this policy that people require a referral from their general practitioner. The reason for that is quite simply the general practitioners are the gatekeepers, and basically the idea is that there are many things. I suppose part of the problem is that part of our job is to try to work out what we think is wrong with the person. Now, sometimes it's very self-evident and you can say there's an appropriate specialist you need to go to see for that, but there are lots of times when there are people who have symptoms that could be potentially seen by 3, 4, 5 different consultants. So rather than having the person traipsing around to 4 or 5 different consultants getting a lot of conflicting advice, the doctor or general practitioner first, who then would refer them on to the relevant and appropriate specialist.
Moving on, Eamon, a listener says she's a lady in her early 50s. She has very itchy legs, no rash, but swelling on her lower limbs. And she's also on a blood thinner, looking for advice.
Yeah, and you'd have to ask the question, why is she on the blood thinner in the first place? What is it that she has? What kind of circulation problem does she have? Where you get itchy legs, the one I think I'd be most, one of the ones that come to the top of the mind straight away would be, does our lady have varicose veins? Because they can lead to varicose eczema, which can be extremely itchy. But it may well be a circulation problem of some sort, again, in the context of her having the itchy legs. Exceptionally rarely, depending on the particular blood thinner, I've had a number of patients who have developed allergic reactions to blood thinners, though I have to stress that that is rare. But for some people, it may be that you might have to change the medication. This is something you should go back and talk to your own doctor about.
Now, Tom from Listowel actually sent a question in last week, and unfortunately I didn't get to it, but he's due to get his hip replaced shortly. The problem at the moment is that his feet are always cold, and he's wondering, is it okay to go ahead with the surgery without getting that checked out?
The general principles are that before anybody has any operation, you will need to be assessed beforehand. Now, that assessment could be relatively informal if it's a relatively a low-grade procedure, or it might be quite high level depending on the amount of surgery involved. The people who will take responsibility for that, for your the anaesthetist, they're not going to put anybody to sleep unless they feel the person can that there's a really, 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 really good chance that the person will recover successfully from the anaesthetic. So that'll be checked out before you have your surgery. It shouldn't of itself be a bar to your having surgery, is what I'm saying.
All right. Another concerned parent has been in touch, Eamon, with a son who's almost 13. He is still wetting the bed 2 or 3 times a week. He's not suffering from anxiety or anything like that.
Listener
is wondering, will this pass or should we get it checked?
Get it checked. Now, the thing is that there are statistics that, I'm trying to remember them now, is that, I can't remember, 21% of 7-year-old boys are potentially bedwetting, 14% of 14-year-old boys, and 1% of 21-year-old men still bedwet. These are ancient and probably out of date figures, but certainly at this stage it's appropriate and proper that you would talk to somebody, and it would be a paediatrician who would be the person who talked about that. Talk to your GP and they can do a referral for you.
Alright, a 46-year-old female says she found a lump in her neck through ultrasound. It was diagnosed as a goiter. She had her bloods done, but it came up that her thyroid was normal. She's wondering, what does she do now?
Okay, it depends. The narrator for this kind of situation, it depends on how troublesome and how bothersome the actual lump is. You can so goiter is merely a swelling of the thyroid gland. It can occur where you are lacking in thyroid hormone, or lacking in iodine is a classic one, where you don't have enough the iodine to produce thyroid hormone. But again, it depends on how much trouble the thing is causing. It can be removed, but the problem is you then have a scar and you have risks of surgery and all the rest of it. Probably a further discussion with your own GP about that. They may well refer you to the relevant specialist, who in this case would be a surgeon, and they'd have a discussion with you as well about what your options are.
Okay, someone's been on to say, wasn't it Dr. Gardisi, that the name of the specialist, but that's not who our listener was looking for. Our listener was looking for the liver specialist, which would be what, an endocrinologist, is it? No?
He was actually a gastroenterologist.
Oh, was it?
And I could say, and it's annoying the hell out of me because I can see the man's face and I could see his kind of name floating around in front of me. Now, I do know that I needed to make sure I get this pronunciation correct as well, so that's another issue for me.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll try and find out the name of our consultant before the programme is over.
Yeah.
And we will let that listener know. Anyway, Eamon, we better let you go because you're a busy man.
Hi,
but thank you for going through all those questions for us.
Thank you, Deirdre. You're
welcome. Talk to you next week. All the best. That's Dr. Eamon Shanahan there, GP in Farran Fort, with this week's Medical Matters. Now, coming up after the break, we're going to be talking about marum grass and why a group called Banna Coast Care are looking for you to give up a little bit of your time this coming weekend to help save the sand dunes.